Welcome back to Issues Etc. This is Hour 3. We're still in the middle of a conversation with Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical Association about yesterday's endorsement by the AMA, the American Medical Association, of human cloning for research purposes. If you'd like to visit the website for the Christian Medical Association, the website address is cmdahome.org. That's cmdahome.org. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Stevens, a couple more questions before we round off our conversation. It was several years ago that President George W. Bush approved, by way of compromise, I believe, 60-plus stem cell lines for research purposes. And you mentioned this before, these stem cell lines have been taken from embryos that had already been sacrificed. The president said, these are the ones you can use no more. I read recently that researchers are saying, look, the 60-plus stem cell lines haven't materialized. And even if they would, that still wouldn't be enough. How do you respond?
Well, the stem cell lines are actually there. 16 of them are located in the United States. But the big problem is groups have patented them and put restrictions and licensing them to people to use. So everybody kind of wants to develop their own. But I think the issue that's actually below that one is this, Todd. Is this the path we should be going down in science? And I think what the story is there is that it's not. Embryonic stem cells have been very highly speculated about what they could do. But essentially in the last two or three years, we've seen little or no progress in that area. Scientists keep running up against a brick wall. Whereas with adult stem cells, which all of us have in our bodies, they're in our bone marrow, they're in our skin, they're in our tooth pulp, they're even in our fat, we are seeing enormous successes. Just this week, Senator Brownback had testimony at the Senate, and they brought a little child in that 5 years ago actually had stem cell transplant from umbilical cord blood and cured his sickle cell disease. There was a father there of another child who had had a rare disorder cured through a stem cell transplant. In Germany, just recently, they did a study where they actually transplanted patients' own stem cells from their bone marrow into the blood vessels of their heart after a heart attack, and it minimized the damage that they had from the heart attack when the tissue had actually died. It was regenerated. So we're seeing enormous successes there. So the bottom line is, should we be throwing a lot of money, federal money and private money, into research which has shown little promise? Or should we be putting our money and efforts into the area where we can really get the cures we all want?
Isn't it also true that for embryonic stem cells to work the way that they're supposed to work, without the fear of massive rejection, they would have to be taken from clones of me in order to work for me under the best case scenario? In other words, I'd have to go out and have myself cloned as many times as necessary to get the stem cells that I would need for what, future Parkinson's or diabetes, if indeed those stem cells could actually work on those diseases.
Right. There's really two issues there. One is you have to actually clone the patient to get a genetic match for the tissue you're going to put back in. So, if this went through and we were successful in this type of research, which I doubt, but if it did happen, the doctor would come to you and say, we need to get some cells from the inside of your cheek, and we're going to actually clone you, create your brother. We'll have to kill your brother, take the cells, manipulate them in the lab, and then turn them into the type of cells we need to treat your diabetes or your stroke or your heart attack. The other thing that people aren't talking about is how many women's eggs it would take to let this cloning take place, because every time you attempt it, you have to have an egg from a woman. I did some calculations for Senator Brownback, which he actually presented on the Senate floor, and it would take every fertile woman in the United States going through hormonal therapy and surgery twice to just cure diabetes and three other diseases that people are talking about. And, of course, that's just totally impossible. Every woman is not going to do that. So this is not only scientifically impossible, it's realistically impractical to do. And so we're just barking up the wrong tree trying to find a cure for these diseases.
Again, I ask, the people who do the research certainly must understand the mathematics of this. And The doctors who are advocating the research, among those some of the AMA, certainly must understand the mathematics as well as you. You're not the first one to point out that it's mathematically impossible to get the number of stem cell lines that they say they need. Why do they continue the push for embryonic stem cell research from human clones?
Follow the money, Todd. Follow the money. I mean, that's essentially the bottom line in this. That and reputations of some scientists in very large medical schools. There's a lot of money to be made if embryonic stem cells are successful, because you can patent the process to cause them to change in the type of tissue you want to use. With adult stem cells, they tend to take on the characteristics of whatever tissue you put them in. So there's not a patentable process there. And so people are interested in this because this is what they can build their reputation on as a scientist. This is what they can patent and become rich. And that's driving this debate.
Finally, with only about 30 seconds, what is the Christian Medical Association's position on human cloning, be it reproductive or for the purposes of research?
Well, our 17,500 members are opposed to both research and reproductive cloning. Both of them involve destroying a developing human life and therefore immoral. And we are who we are at the one cell stage, just like you and I are who we are now. And so we should oppose that. One other thing I should mention as we close, Todd, you mentioned our website. If people want to find a Christian doctor in their own area, they can go to the website, put in the specialty they're looking for, and their zip code, and find a Christian doctor. I think it's more and more important with these issues that we find physicians and dentists that share our own worldview.
Thank you very much, Dr. Stevens, for being our guest.
God bless you.
Dr. David Stevens is executive director of the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. If you'd like to visit their website and perhaps even through that process find a doctor that shares your values and your concerns on these very issues, their website address, cmdahome.org, cmdahome.org. It's the website for the Christian Medical Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking about paganism. Dr. David Adams joins us here in Studio A. He is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. What in the world is a pagan? What's the difference between, say, a pagan and a heathen? More importantly, two questions. Are all non-Christians pagans? And most importantly, how does the Bible use this word, if it does at all? We'll talk about that during this hour. Our phone number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. David Adams, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
David, let's begin with Merriam-Webster. I have a dictionary definition sitting in front of me. It's not from the Unabridged, but it is from the popular dictionary of Merriam-Webster for the word pagan. And it has two definitions. One, a follower of a polytheistic religion, and then it says, as in ancient Rome. And the second definition is one who has little or no religion and who delights in sensual pleasures and material goods, an irreligious or hedonistic person. How does that definition or that set of definitions stack up against the scriptural definition for a pagan?
Well, the difficulty whenever we use terms like pagan and heathen is that, I mean, you read the Merriam-Webster, I assume that's the most recent edition.
Yes, it is.
Definition. You know, if we go back to, I've got in front of me, I grabbed quickly the second edition, Webster's second edition, which is, you know, quite a bit older. And the first definition of pagan there is simply somebody who is not a Christian. In other words, anybody who is not a Christian is a pagan. And then it goes on in subsequent lower. It says, well, actually, it says formerly a person who was not a Christian, now a person who is not a Christian, Muslim, or Jew. In other words, someone from the monotheistic religions related in some general way to the Bible.
It sounds as though the definition is shifting over time.
Well, words do that. All words do that. Language is always a moving target. And one of the difficulties in when we talk about translating the Bible, since I teach biblical studies and Hebrew, one of the difficulties in translating the Bible is getting the right word with the right connotation in our generation. Because words that have a certain connotation or a certain meaning, by the way, when we talk about words and meaning, we often distinguish between the denotative meaning and the connotative meaning of a word. The denotative meaning having to do with the kind of definition that you read a moment ago, you know, the etymological meaning, how the word is, you know, what the word in the strictest sense may mean, in a narrower sense, the connotative meaning having to do more with how people react when they hear the word, you know, the kind of emotional response. The word pagan, as we were just talking about, really means, or has, I mean, first it comes from a Latin word that means somebody who dwells in the field. That's the etymology of the word.
You know, who lives outside the town.
Who lives outside the town. So anybody who lives in the country is a pagan in the etymological sense. Of course, that's not how we use the word today. We never use that word today. What we mean by pagan is somebody who's, to use the English phrase, beyond the pale in terms of religion. As to say, they're outside the bounds of religion, acceptable religion as we understand it. And for most, for Christians, that historically has meant Christianity. In American Western society, as we become increasingly tolerant of people in other religions, the term pagan has, you know, people who are outside the pale of acceptable religion, has moved farther and farther out.
Because the group of religions that are deemed acceptable has grown.
Has grown. Now we're not talking theologically. We're talking about people's cultural perceptions.
Now, I imagine that in the next or the next edition of popular dictionaries, the term pagan will take on its more particular meaning, which I deal with more on this program, and that is earth religions. Gaia, Wicca, religions tied to the earth, the seasons, the change of seasons, which is what in popular literature today, the term pagan usually means, but it's a very narrow definition as opposed to, as you said, formerly, anything outside of Christendom.
Right. And you're absolutely right. That is the way paganism is most commonly used today. It's used to refer to those groups that are a revival of the nature worship of ancient religious times. Now, even so, there will be those who will complain about the use of the word, even in that restricted sense, which is technically very correct. But there will be those who complain about it because of the negative connotation of the word pagan. See, in our culture, in our society, the word pagan, not only does it have this denotative meaning that we've been talking about, but layered on top of that is the connotation of pagan is something negative. It's something bad. It's to call someone as a pagan is to insult them, is to somehow suggest that they're culturally inferior. So in our all-embracing multicultural society, at least the one that would like to be that in which we live, the word pagan is increasingly unacceptable to be used of anyone, even those to whom it clearly technically applies. You know, in terms of nature worship,
it seems to be taking on the meaning of a very closely associated word, the meaning that it's had for a long time, and that is the term heathen, which means, and still does, an irreligious person.
Right. And even in the second edition, and I flipped to the front here and see when the second edition of Webster's was published, but it's, I want to say it's like 1930s or something like that. This edition, yeah, 34.
So it's a rather old dictionary.
Right. But even in this edition, it says it's a synonym for heathen. Pagan is now applied to one of the ancient polytheistic peoples, and heathen is applied to any of the peoples regarded as uncivilized idolaters. That's the distinction, you know, that our parents and grandparents would have grown up with. That heathen means, you know, has this extra connotation of being uncivilized. And you're right, pagan increasingly has that same connotation of being uncivilized, slightly unsavory or undesirable.
Okay, so we find ourselves, as an example, in a public forum, a public cultural forum, the open marketplace of ideas. Is it possible for Christians to use the term pagan without being completely misunderstood, even if they're talking about Wiccans or, much less, Muslims or Jews? Is it possible for them to use it in the classical sense, that is, anything outside the pale of Christianity?
Of course it's possible for them. It's possible for us to use the word that way. We have to anticipate that we're going to be misunderstood. Now, I grew up in the South, in Tennessee, and I grew up, I was born in 1955, so you know my formative years were late 50s through the middle 60s. And when I grew up, we used certain racially oriented words to refer to people of different races. I'm white or Caucasian. When I grew up, I don't want to offend anybody here, so I'm going to use a word that's not culturally acceptable today just to illustrate my point. So please don't take offense at my use of the word because I think I'm using it to illustrate a point appropriately. When I grew up, it was quite commonplace for us to refer to Afro-Americans or blacks as niggers. Now, we didn't mean anything particularly negative by that term. It was just a term to refer to, you know, the fact that they had more melanin in their skin than we did. That term in the mid-60s started to have a very negative connotation and has increasingly done so down to this day, so that today no white person can use that word without expecting to know they're going to cause offense in the public arena.
Is the same true of pagan in the open marketplace of ideas that we find ourselves in our pluralistic, religiously pluralistic American society?
Well, we haven't gone that far yet, but that's the trajectory that we're on. So that to refer to someone as a pagan is increasingly like using one of those racially charged words. Now, we're not there yet. You know, we're maybe two-thirds of the way there right now.
It's on its way to becoming an epithet.
That's right, exactly.
All right.
To give you an example of where this is going, a few years ago when I worked in Washington, D.C., I wrote a weekly newsletter on church and state issues. And one week I referred to I used the phrase Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and other non-Christian groups. And I got a very critical letter from a Canadian group who basically berated me intensively for referring to Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses as non-Christians, you know, and said how I was insulting them and, treating them basically as second-class human beings by saying they were non-Christians. I wrote them back and, I have friends who are Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses that I worked with in Washington, D.C. at the time. And I certainly wasn't intending to be insulting toward them. I was tending to state a certain theological fact. That is that within the bounds of historic Christianity, they do not stand. If we were to sit down and talk about that theologically, what historic Christianity stood for, they would recognize that they didn't stand there. And so if a term like non-Christian has already started to take on these kind of epithet qualities, just to refer to someone as a non-Christian is almost an insult. How much more if I had used the word pagan or heathen in that newsletter 3 or 4 years ago? I'm sure this organization that wrote to me from Canada would have hurled fire and brimstone at me and not just ink and paper.
All right. Now let's get to the heart of the matter, which is beyond Merriam-Webster mm-hmm. and beyond popular usage and how people perceive the term pagan. Can we arrive at a biblical definition of the term pagan? Or maybe we should say, what words have been translated from Old and New Testament as pagan?
Yeah. It's difficult in the Old Testament, which is really my area. There's not one single word that regularly gets translated as pagan. Most often the people are referred to by name, you know, the Hivites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Egyptians, the Canaanites, and so forth. There's not, the Old Testament has this, in Hebrew has the term goyim. Most people have heard that from Jewish usage, the, you know, goyim, the Gentiles. That tends to refer to anybody who's not of the people of Israel. That's more of simply an us versus them word. It's not so much religiously loaded, although it does have that connotation in certain verses, particularly in the prophets where the Lord talks about the harvest of the Gentiles coming in. But it's really there more those who are outside of the people whom God has called to be his own, which I guess, in a sense, is the way we use pagan also. Although we don't usually, I don't think I've ever seen goyim actually translated pagan in the Old
Testament.
I have.
I checked it out before we talked, and I found that in the one instance I could find in the Old Testament where the word pagan appeared, and it talked mm-hmm. about your pagan gods, the term there was goyim, gods of the nations.
Gods of the nations.
Or of the Gentiles.
Do you remember which translation that was?
You know, it was, in fact, the New American Standard Version.
Oh.
Which surprised me.
Yeah.
In the New Testament.
If you'd asked me, I would have said it must have been King James.
King James doesn't use the word pagan, by the way.
I didn't think it did.
In the New Testament, there is a parallel word in Greek for goyim, the Hebrew word for nations or Gentiles, and that is the term ethne.
Ethnos, yeah.
So talk about that a bit, if you would.
Well, again, ethnos is, I mean, there's another term in Greek, a parallel term, barbaros, which we know is barbarian, which is a little more negative in terms of its connotation than ethne, which really just simply means a cultural a group, a people group. Barbaroi, the outsiders, is more specifically the equivalent of the Hebrew goyim. They're the people who aren't Greeks, in other words. Ethne is a little more, in terms of connotation, a little more neutral. Barbaroi is a little more negative.
Although we will find St. Paul using that term when you once walked amongst the ethne,
right.
The nations. And then he talks a long laundry list of the things that they did when they were among the nations formerly, before they were Christians, seems to have the connotation of before you believed, when you were an unbeliever.
Yes, no, that's correct. In that sense, ethne is simply used to translate the same thing goyim means in the Old Testament, those who were outside of the people of God. But I was speaking in general about Greek usage. Ethne doesn't have quite as negative a connotation as barbaroi does.
So can we say that, based upon what Scripture says, mm-hmm. that God has a definition of the term pagan, and if so, what would that be?
Well, God has. I'm sorry. This tripped my academic hat here. You know, when you teach long enough, you start splitting hairs very fine. If my wife is listening, she puts up with this all the time, and so tripped one of my wires there for a second, and I had to debate how much I was going to talk about it.
Well, you've got about a minute.
Okay. Well, since God doesn't have a definition of a term in that sense, he doesn't speak English. Certainly God has an equivalent concept that we would use traditionally the term pagan for, and it's the one we've already talked about, because in God's view, everyone who is outside of the circle of God's people is outside the faith. It's beyond the pale, or pagan in that sense. So in a sense, Merriam-Webster's original, the second edition's formerly definition, is the way that Christianity would normally understand the word pagan. Anybody who is not a Christian is a pagan in traditional Christian terms. Again, not with the cultural connotations that we have today, but with the denotation of the term as being out beyond the pale of religion that's acceptable to God.
When we come back from the break, with that said, God says all who are outside the pale of Christianity are pagans. Has the word been lost to us for all practical purposes? We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What should a Christian do when he finds out about mismanagement of funds at work? How should you deal with a supervisor who always takes credit for your work? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Christian Ethics in the Workplace is written by a theologian, an executive, and a business school professor. In this book, you'll find out how to prevent corporate scandals like Enron, Global Crossing, and WorldCom. The cost is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Christian Ethics in the Workplace, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. For more information, Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
Life, could scientists ever duplicate it? Answers with Ken Ham, host of the popular film, The Genesis Solution. Well, Ken, do you think scientists will ever create life in a laboratory?
When I went to school in Australia, my teachers told me that scientists were trying to produce life in a lab. But I realized that even if they did, it certainly would not be evidence for evolution. Now think about this. Here's an evolutionary scientist with 50 years dedicated research, millions of dollars worth of equipment, and he says, if I can just make life here in a test tube, I've proven no intelligence was necessary in the beginning. You see, even if scientists did make life in a test tube, the effort will have nothing to do with chance random processes, but everything to do with intelligence. And you know, that's what we see in the world. It always takes information to get information. Machines don't arise by chance. Our observations in science fit exactly with what the Bible tells us, that an infinite intelligence provided the information, the code systems for life. Our Creator God is responsible for everything that's here.
More faith-building information on the book of Genesis is found on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. We like to believe it's one of the most attractive and easy-to-use sites on the entire Internet. Well, this week you can read Ken Ham's free booklet on the origin of so-called races. Look us up at AnswersRadio.com and read many of our free booklets there, including The Origin of the So-Called Races. That's AnswersRadio.com.
:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis. Overnight, mostly cloudy, a chance for rain. Low near 66. For Thursday, partly cloudy, a bit cooler. Highs near 80 tomorrow. Right now, it's overcast and 88 in St. Louis. For the remaining 25 minutes of Issues Etc. this afternoon, we'll continue the discussion on pagans. That's next, right here on AM 850 KFUO. Another look at St. Louis traffic, westbound 40 between Clayton, Skinker, and Hanley. Stop-and-go traffic there. Also crowded 270 through Mason. Southbound 270 between Ledoux Road and Doherty Ferry, there's some slow traffic. Eastbound 40 between McKnight and Hanley, some slow traffic there. Northbound 55 between 44 and the Poplar Street Bridge, some slow traffic in the right lane. And eastbound 40 between Compton and the Poplar Street Bridge, heavy traffic is there. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO.
Next time on Focus on the Family, Dr. James Dobson and author Gary Smalley examine the human spirit. Together, they explain how conflict or loneliness can close a person's heart, making healthy, loving relationships difficult. It's a look at healing emotional heart trouble, coming up on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to talk about Sunday School with Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House. She'll be here. We'll also be talking with Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University about the upcoming conference of the U.S. Catholic Bishops. Now, there's an additional story there that I'd like to talk with Hitchcock, and that has to do with the bishop in Phoenix, who not only was recently divested of much of his authority by the state, but also was indicted and arrested for a hit and run. Get his reaction to that tomorrow on the program. We'll also be talking about meeting the ethical tests in the workplace with Jim Truesdell, one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. The last 25 minutes of the program, we're continuing our conversation with Dr. David Adams, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We're talking about paganism. We've established in the first 20 minutes or so, that in fact the term pagan is shifting in its definition. However, the concept of pagan, that is, anything outside the pale of the people of God or outside the pale of Christianity, is still pagan. So while the concept remains very firmly rooted in Scripture, both Old and New Testaments, the word itself, pagan, P-A-G-A-N, well, it might be lost to us. We'll find out as we continue our conversation. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. David, is it your opinion at this point, because of course as who knows what words could be lost to us in the future as usage changes? Is it your opinion that the term pagan is lost to Christian usage, that we are simply unwise to use it in any context?
We certainly have to be careful the way we use it when we're speaking in the public square and speaking to and with non-Christians, because, as I was saying with using racially charged terms, there are those out there who will take offense where none is intended. And so we simply have to be careful, remembering that the Scripture reminds us to let our speech be seasoned with salt so that we know how to speak to every person. We have to be sensitive to how people will misunderstand what we mean so that they don't get distracted from the gospel. You know, the fact is that Satan is always happy to do anything he can to get people to think about anything other than Christ and the gospel. And so that if they can take one of these side issues and make something of it, they often will. And so our responsibility is to not allow that to happen so that we can keep the focus on Christ and the gospel.
Now, within the Christian family, the intra-Christian conversation that is among believers, is the term paganism still a useful term for us?
It certainly is. I mean, in every field of knowledge, there is jargon. In radio, there is, I know. Mm-hmm. And in theology, we have a whole fistful of jargon that we use all the time. To use pagan as a technical term for anyone who's not a Christian is entirely appropriate within the within Christian circles. And frankly, it's not inappropriate to use it even when talking with non-Christians. We just have to be prepared for the negative response that we'll get sometimes. And so I don't want to discourage people from using the term. What I think we need to do is to be wise as serpents, as St. Paul says, remember that we may give people an opportunity to be distracted from hearing the message of Christ in some cases, and we want to be careful about doing that.
How would you respond to someone who does say, look, the term pagan is just too negative, and to use it in any context, be it the public square or even in intra-Christian conversation where we're discussing the unbelieving world, is no longer acceptable? How would you respond to that?
I guess I would ask what term would be better. If the point is that it's unacceptably insulting, then is not non-Christian just as unacceptably insulting? It is to these people that I was speaking of, in Canada, who were highly offended by my referring to Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses as non-Christian. So what about terms that we other parallel terms that we use, like unbelievers? That term has a certain negative connotation to it. To say someone is an unbeliever, just the fact that there's an un on the front, it makes it a negative term. Shall we not use any of those terms? I think we have to be careful in the way that, the way that we allow people to push us around with regard to our use of language and not give up on terms where they have legitimate meaning.
Most anyone observing the culture is going to say, look, there is a language movement afoot, and it's called political correctness.
Right.
And it is a movement primarily of words and of language, and that is to restrict the usage of words and thereby to restrict ideas that are deemed inappropriate for public discourse. The church is a victim of this, as is all of the culture. You mentioned the term unbelievers. It doesn't seem popular, especially in evangelical circles, to refer to unbelievers anymore. Now we talk about seekers or, people who are earnestly looking for something. We eschew the term unbeliever. Do you believe that this is a bow not only to political correctness, but more deeply a theological movement?
Yes, I do. Here's the danger that I see. And you touched on it. In fact, you said it in passing. The ultimate point of the political correctness movement is not to prevent certain words from being used, but to prevent certain ideas from being thought. And the same thing ultimately applies to in the culture to religious issues. In the culture, there is this sense that we must affirm all religions as being equal. Therefore, we cannot use any terms that imply one religion is superior or inferior to another. That would be the way the theological correctness or political correctness crowd would work with regard to theology. And we simply cannot allow that as faithful Christians. We cannot allow ourselves to be placed in a position where we are willing to give the impression that all religions are created equal and that all roads lead to the same place. To the extent that we do that, we are compromising the gospel and the message of Jesus Christ, who said, "I am the way, the truth, the life. No one will come to the Father except through me."
There's another term that is very popular now, and I think it has originated primarily from Christians, and that term is people of faith, which, as far as I can tell, pretty much includes everybody. By that definition, could anyone be outside the pale of acceptable Christianity?
Well, you know, people of faith, at least as it's used in Washington, D.C., tends to refer to people of any faith, that is to say, you know, people who belong to pagan religions, nature worship religions, as we were talking about before, would equally be people of faith. They would be people of some faith. Some people use that term in a more restricted sense to refer to Christians, Muslims, Jews, those who are somehow, again, connected to the broader tradition of the Bible. But, I think, again, all these circumlocutions are ultimately intended to avoid one thing, and that's saying to somebody, you are damned because of your unbelief in Jesus Christ. We don't want to say that. That is, we being the culture. We don't want to offend people by saying that. And even some of us in the church have embraced this point, where we are simply afraid to stand up and say, you who have rejected Christ are damned by your rejection of him and under God's eternal judgment. And you need to hear that. You know, that's not very visitor-friendly in churches. That's not the sort of thing that people look forward to hearing. They are offended by it. And yet it is what St. Paul refers to as the scandalon, the stumbling block of the cross.
I'd like to talk about a few passages that we've alluded to before in just a minute here, Bible passages having to do with this basic concept that remains intact, thank God it does, that there is the circle of faith, that is true faith in Jesus Christ, and outside of that, whatever you call them, pagans, unbelievers, there is a distinction here, and not all religions are the same. Folks, if you have a question or a comment on paganism, you can call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Car phone callers, internet callers, first-time callers will get top priority at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Where would you go to find, in a nutshell, this concept, that either Old or New Testament, that there is the circle of faith that is acceptable unto God, that is in the true God, and outside of this or is the unbelieving world, the pagan world?
Well, I just finished teaching a class called Exodus in the Torah that I teach regularly at the seminary. And so the first passage that jumps to my mind is a passage from the book of Exodus. The very first time in Exodus 3, the first time in the Old Testament that God calls the Hebrews my people. God never uses the phrase my people in the book of Genesis. He talks about the descendants of Abraham, and clearly he speaks of Abraham in a way that indicates that Abraham has a special relationship to him. But the passage that jumps out to me immediately is from Exodus 3, where for the first time, almost in passing, without making a big deal of it, God refers to the Hebrews as my people. And the very fact that God calls some people his implies that there are some who are outside. Later in the book of Exodus, God calls the Hebrews his own special possession, his treasured possession. Again, this implies, you know, even though he has, you know, the whole world belongs to him, they are his special possession. And then from there, you know, throughout the Old Testament, this notion continues that in calling a people and making them his own, that God has made, has drawn a circle around this people and blessed them in a way that, with a knowledge and with a relationship in a way that excludes others who are outside that. We, in theology, we call this the scandal of particularity, that God has called a particular people to be his own. The same continues in the New Testament, where time and again we read the word of God. Many are called, but few are chosen, for example, from the New Testament. The New Israel, all the New Israel language in the New Testament, again, points to the fact that God has a specific people that he has made his own.
And this is not to say that God has a specific ethnic group. He has a specific nationality or a specific bloodline that he has made his own. But in fact, he has called these people by revealing himself ultimately in Jesus Christ. Those outside the faith cannot be called people of faith because they're outside the faith, the true Christian faith. Is that the basic idea here?
That's correct. The new Israel is defined not by descending from Adam, or rather from Abraham biologically, but descending from Abraham's faith. Those who have Abraham's faith are the new Israel, the new people of God.
You mentioned the book of Exodus, and I am thinking about the first genuine moment of drama past the Exodus, which comes after God has revealed himself to Moses, and Moses is headed down from the Mount Sinai. And in the meantime, under the direction of the people, Aaron, Moses' brother, has made an idol for the people to worship. And he points to the idol being the golden calf and does not say, this is the calf god of Egypt, yada, 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 or something like that. He says, this is your God who brought you out of Egypt, with reference to the true God.
That's correct. Exodus 32.
What is going on there where he would point at an idol and say, it's the God that Moses is talking to up on the mountain?
Well, you may have heard of a book that was published a few years ago called, what was the exact title? Evangelical Style Lutheran Substance, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We won't mention the author's name since he's not here to defend himself or to respond in kind. But what we have in Exodus 32, at least in Aaron's mind, I think if you look at Exodus 32, there's a disconnect between what Aaron thinks is happening and what the rest of the people think are happening. And God, in this sense, says, no, Aaron, you're wrong. The rest of the people are right. They're not just worshiping me using this golden calf. They're actually worshiping other gods. But so it's a very fascinating passage in Exodus 32. But in some sense, what's happening there is, in Aaron's mind, is they're using a kind of Egyptian style, you know, with Yahwistic substance. You know, we're going to worship Yahweh. We're just going to do it in a way that's acceptable to the, you know, to the Egyptian culture, or reminds us of the Egyptian culture we're comfortable with. A similar thing happens later on at the division of the kingdoms from, you know, after Solomon's death. The northern kingdom of Israel divides from the southern kingdom, and the kings of the northern kingdom set up a temple in Bethel, you'll recall. And there, apparently the original intention was that the temple in Bethel should be used to worship the true God, Yahweh, not to worship other gods. It didn't last very long, and they quickly drifted into the worship of other gods as well. But the original intention seems to have been to worship the true God there. They brought in, again, idols and images to use there in the temple of Bethel. And so there we have a sort of Canaanite-style Yahwistic substance. So substance, or rather style, does matter in worship, at least in the Bible it does. Not every element of style is equal. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that that there is a simple, you know, dividing point. But style is not always theologically neutral.
The technical term, if I'm not mistaken, for the practice that we find in Aaron, those who attempted to worship God in Bethel, there are other instances, of course, of people worshiping false gods, but calling them by the name of the true God, calling them Yahweh, is syncretism. Is this the essential idolatrous temptation and error of the Old Testament people of God when they fell into idolatry?
Yes, you almost, I can't recall off the top of my head any place in the Old Testament where the people of Israel consciously reject Yahweh. Well, they say, we're not going to worship Yahweh anymore. if you look through Kings, you know, Samuel, Kings, all those books leading up to the fall of Jerusalem, it's always that they're worshiping other gods along with Yahweh. Now, it may be that, you know, the worship of those other gods has more or less completely displaced the worship of Yahweh at some point, but they've never consciously said, we're rejecting Yahweh and turning to Baal. It's always the equation of Baal with Yahweh, or the worship of Baal alongside of Yahweh. You know, if asked, I'm sure the Israelites would have said, no, you know, we're continuing to worship the God who revealed himself to Moses. We're just doing it, you know, using either images and things like the Asherah poles associated with Canaanite worship, or we're worshiping those gods too, but we're not rejecting Yahweh. So syncretism is then the bringing together, the mixing of faiths. We traditionally use that term in English circles, English-speaking circles, to mean the mixing of Christian and non-Christian faiths. It could technically mean the mixing of any two faiths. But, syncretistic elements in the Old Testament are where the people of God got into trouble, because they were willing, at first, you see, it starts off in the most subtle way. God warns them about this in Exodus and in Deuteronomy. He says, when you go into the land, be sure you drive all these people out and destroy their temples and their Asherah poles. Otherwise, your sons will marry their daughters, your daughters will marry their sons, and you'll, in effect, start tolerating them. And then after tolerating them, you'll become like them. The same thing happens in Solomon's life. Solomon marries these wives from other nations, and he allows them to worship their gods. He doesn't himself start off by worshiping false gods, but he allows his wives to do so. Then later, we find that Solomon has himself taken up the worship of those false gods.
Is this concept of the pagan, that there is... That outside the pale of the Orthodox Christian faith, that there is a line drawn there between those who are within the Orthodox Christian faith and those who are outside, and that is a line that can't be blurred or smudged or written in a dashed form. It is a bold line between those who believe in the true God and those who do not. You stand on one side of that line or you stand on the other, period. Is that concept, if not the word pagan, useful in understanding the true danger of what we've just been talking about, and that is syncretism, the blurring of lines between the true God and false gods?
It's not only useful, it's absolutely vital. Now, we cannot compromise on the idea that there are those who stand outside the Christian faith and who are damned by virtue of that fact, whether we call them non-Christians, whether we call them unbelievers, whether we call them people of other faiths or differently faithed people, try to be as polite as we can about it. But in the end, if we compromise that notion that those who stand outside of Christ are damned, then we have given up the gospel, and we've given up all motivation for evangelism and mission as well.
Does it necessarily serve the purposes of evangelism, of mission, of the gospel, to be as polite as we possibly can be when coming to that issue? And that is, as you said before, the moment where one must say, you stand outside the Christian faith, you have rejected the only Savior, Jesus Christ, and by virtue of that, you will, if you do not come to faith, go to hell. Does it serve us to be polite all the time when it comes to that issue?
All the time, no. Certainly not when it's raised so directly. One may avoid using the term pagans, for example, because one wants to keep the conversation going. But when it comes to the point where that very question is at issue, what is my relationship before God, then we have to speak with absolute clarity and say to someone, I don't want you to be offended by this, but if you're not trusting in Jesus Christ for your salvation, if you haven't received God's grace in Jesus Christ, then you are damned.
One last question. Are even the respectable religions, that's a growing group, by the way,
yes,
but let's talk about the monotheistic religions, Islam, Judaism, are they pagan according to the definition, the concept that we have laid out here from Scripture?
Absolutely. If by pagan we mean those who stand outside the pale of God's people, then they absolutely are. And it's not intended to be an insult to them. It's simply intended to define their relationship before God.
What separates a Christian from a pagan?
What separates a Christian from a pagan is having received the grace of God in faith in Jesus Christ and being redeemed by God's salvific work on the cross. It's not that we have deserved that work, but only that God himself, by his grace, has given us faith through which we might trust in him.
By using the term pagan, or even if occasionally labeling someone pagan, are we saying that they are outside the reach of God's mercy for all time and eternity? Are we saying that they are damned one way or the other? Are we saying that the gospel is not for them too?
No, we're certainly not. If anything, we ought to be saying the opposite of that. We ought to be saying, here is someone whom I see and have identified as being in need of hearing the message of God's love in Jesus Christ. Here is someone with whom I care enough about that I want to share God's love with them. And so we're not saying that they're beyond the scope of salvation. We're saying, here's someone that we need to speak God's message of salvation to. You know, the onus really falls upon us to be witnesses of God's grace to them. That is, after all, why God has left the church here in the world, that we might bear the message of Christ and his cross to the ends of the earth. To do that, we have to know whom to speak to.
Dr. David Adams, thank you for your time, and thanks for being our guest on Issues Etc. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. You see what it comes down to, folks? If we are unwilling or unable to identify the pagan, the person who stands outside the true faith, how can we ever bring them to true faith? How can we ever preach the gospel message to anyone if no one needs it? If we're unwilling to say that someone is an unbeliever, if we're unwilling to say that someone is outside the true Christian faith, if we're unwilling to say that someone is, in fact, as Scripture defines it, a pagan, then who are we going to do evangelism to? You see, if the Muslim and the Jew aren't pagans, then they don't need the gospel. They're just people of faith. They're just people differently faithed from us. No real difference. But if there is a real difference, the difference being the person and work of Jesus Christ and faith in him, they need that Jesus Christ. We do them a favor when we understand them to be pagans in need of the gospel. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.